Okay, everyone. So now we can move on with the sutras. And as I said yesterday, I wanted to do quite a bit of background, first of all, to look at the more general aspects of how the Buddha talks about the suttas in general. So we had quite a bit of look at the Mahaparinibbana Sutta yesterday. And today I want to continue a little bit more in terms of background things, just to give us some kind of framework for how to understand the suttas. So I'm going to do a little bit more of that this morning here. So the next sutta is called Future Perils, Anagata Bayani in the Pali language. And this is about the sort of things that, according to the Buddha, will lead to the decline of Buddhism in the future, right? So we are now in the future. So this is the future already, from the Buddha's point of view. So now is the time to kind of be careful about these things. So let's have a look. There's actually four suttas altogether that are called the Future Perils. And this is just one of those four suttas. So this is on page 6. Because there are these five future perils as yet unarisen that will arise in the future, you should recognize them and make an effort to abandon them. What are the five? In the future, there will be bhikkhus who are undeveloped in body, undeveloped in virtuous behavior, undeveloped in mind, and undeveloped in wisdom. They will give full ordination to others, but will not be able to discipline them in the higher virtuous behavior, in the higher mind, and the higher wisdom. These pupils too will be undeveloped in body, undeveloped in virtuous behavior, undeveloped in mind, and undeveloped in wisdom. They in turn will give full ordination to others, but will not be able to discipline them in the higher virtuous behavior, the higher mind, and the higher wisdom. These pupils too will be undeveloped in body, virtuous behavior, mind, and wisdom. Thus, because corruption of the Dhamma, through corruption of the Dhamma comes corruption of the discipline, and from corruption of the discipline comes corruption of the Dhamma. This is the first future peril as yet unarisen that will arise in the future. You should recognize it and make an effort to abandon it. So here it tells us about the problem. If somebody doesn't practice properly and somebody doesn't actually gain the benefits of the practice, then of course they cannot pass that on to the next generation. This is what this really is about. So once one generation does not understand what is going on, we can expect that this problem will kind of keep on going down the generation from one generation to the next. So that's why it starts off with this idea of being undeveloped in body, virtuous behavior, mind, and wisdom. Undeveloped in body does not mean that you haven't gone enough to the gym, right? That's not what it means. It sounds a bit like it, right? So it's a strange expression in the Pali language, this idea of being undeveloped in the body. What it actually means is that you have not practiced sense restraint. So this is a kind of an unusual expression for that. And I'm not sure exactly why they use that expression, but that is the contextual meaning. When you know the suttas in broader context, that is actually what it means. So the body, in that sense, is the five senses and the way that you restrain them from giving rise to defilements, right? That is undeveloped in bodies. Not really restrained, nor are you developed in virtuous behavior. You haven't really practiced properly, and here, of course, virtuous behavior is a quite high, usually, the meaning here. It includes things like the mind not having developed metta and kindness and getting away from anger and these kind of things. Undeveloped in mind means that you haven't really practiced your meditation, your samadhi. And of course, the wisdom is the insight that arises from that samadhi and meditation practice. So pretty much in all areas you have failed. And of course, if you fail in all those areas, you haven't much to say to the next generation. You may be able to know some theory about the Dhamma from the suttas, but you haven't really got that understanding which is required to be able to pass on the message of the Buddha in a proper way. This is why the next generation too, you can't discipline them, it says here. The Pali word, as I understand it, really means training. Vineti. Vineti is the word. It's a kind of word thing you do when you train a horse. Right? Vineti. Discipline is kind of okay, but it sounds a bit harsh. But I think training is a better word to use in this particular case. You can't train them in the higher virtuous behavior. So this is like virtue in its broader context. The higher mind usually refers to the jhana states, the deep states of samadhi. And the higher wisdom then means that ability to see things according to reality, as you do when you become an Arya, right? So all of these things are very high things, but you lack that ability. So the next generation is just as stupid as the previous generation. And then you pass on that stupidity down the line from one generation to the next one. And it shows you the importance in Buddhism of not just having the suttas, but also having those people who realize these things. If you just have the suttas, often it turns out not to be enough. Or if you just have the suttas, you don't have the realization, it means you don't really appreciate the suttas in the first place. Often it is by realizing the Dhamma that you start to appreciate the power of the Buddha and the power of the suttas. Without that, it's actually often much more difficult. And then you kind of turn away. And we'll see that in a second, that this actually is the case also in this particular sutta. So realization and suttas together is one of those very powerful things in the Buddhist teachings. It's so nice. To me, that has always been one of those powerful inspirations, the idea that you have this ancient teaching, been passed down through 2,500 years, right, from generation to generation. In every generation, there are people who realize this and pass it on. And of course, one of the great benefits of that, the fact that it is an ancient teaching, is that we are all looking back to the Buddha as our teacher. And what that means, we all have the same teacher, in a sense. It means that there is more kind of equality between Buddhists in the present world, even between monastics and lay people, right? Because we're all looking back to the same teacher. It means that nobody should really kind of get too above themselves and think that I am the leader of Buddhism in the present world, because the Buddha is still there in the background. If you have some kind of modern cult, it's a very different thing, because in a modern cult, there will be a cult leader, and they will be the ones who are kind of on top of the hierarchy, which makes it more dangerous, right? Because you don't have that final authority which goes back a long time in the past. This is the advantage of having some authority which everybody can sort of take as their teacher, in a sense. But at the same time, it is very difficult just to read the suttas and practice only on that basis. It's so important to also see the living example, right? People practicing in the right way, seeing people who have real kindness and real peace in their lives, people who have real wisdom. When you see that, sometimes you can feel that when you are in the presence of certain people. There's a certain power there, a certain peace, something beautiful going on. And then you have the example and the ancient teachings coming together, and then it actually feels something very special going on there. So that is what what we are saying here, right? And then because that lack of wisdom gets passed down through from generation to generation, it means that there is a corruption happening. The Dhamma no longer has the ability to make people realize the Buddhist teaching. That is a kind of corruption. That's why he says at the end here, through the corruption of the Dhamma comes the corruption of the discipline. Right? The corruption of the Dhamma, because they haven't really understood the Dhamma through their own practice. So for that reason, there is they're not able to pass it on. And then comes the corruption of the discipline. Again, the word here is vinaya. And the vinaya in the early suttas, as far as I'm concerned, means more like the training. It is the practical side. So you have the Dhamma, which is the doctrine and the teaching. And the vinaya is the action that you do based on that teaching. It's like the training. So it's theory and practice, right? Doctrine and training, if you like. Something like that. So if you have the wrong teaching here, don't understand what you're going to do, you're going to train in the wrong way, right? You're not going to practice properly. You're not going to get the results of meditation practice and all these kind of things because you don't really know what you're doing. And if you don't know what you're doing, then of course that corrupts your vision of the Dhamma again because you haven't seen the Dhamma properly. So from the corruption of the training, there is the corruption of the Dhamma, the teaching itself. You haven't seen it properly, you can't pass it on to the next generation. You can see the problem there, right? So realization is so important on this Buddhist path. So you should recognize this danger and you should make an effort to abandon it. In other words, you should try to avoid falling into this trap. That's what it means here. So the idea of full ordination here is the upasampada, is the status of the bhikkhu or bhikkhuni that is meant. So you pass that on from one generation to the next one. The next one here, number two, is very similar to the first one here. In the future, there will be bhikkhus who are, again, undeveloped in body, virtuous behavior, and mind and wisdom. And they will give dependence to others, but will not be able to teach them or train them in the higher virtuous behavior, the higher mind, and the higher wisdom. The only difference between this paragraph and the previous one is that here you give dependence rather than give the full ordination. And giving dependence or giving support, if you like, means to be somebody's teacher. In the previous one, you are the upajaya, that is the one who ordains. Here, you are just the teacher. But otherwise, it's exactly the same thing here. These are just technical differences in the Vinaya. So not really all that important. And of course, the same problem arises. These pupils too will be undeveloped in body, virtuous behavior, mind and wisdom. They in turn will give support to others or will be the teachers of others, but will not be able to train them in the higher virtuous behavior, in the samadhi states and in the penetrative wisdom. These pupils too will be undeveloped in body, virtue, mind and wisdom. Thus, because through the corruption of the teaching comes the corruption of the training. From the corruption of the training comes the corruption of the teaching. This is the second future peril as yet unarisen that will arise in the future. You should recognize it and make an effort to abandon it. Again, in the future, there will be bhikkhus who are undeveloped in body, virtue, mind, and wisdom. They will engage in talk pertaining to the Dhamma, in questions and answers, and they will slide down into a dark Dhamma, but will not recognize it. Thus, because through the corruption of the teaching comes the corruption of the training, and from the corruption of the training comes the corruption of the teaching. This is the third future peril as yet unarisen that will arise in the future, and you should recognize it and make an effort to abandon it. Right, so again, these are the monastics who have not really developed the path properly. They haven't got the insight and the samadhi and all of these kind of things. And then while they talk here about the Dhamma, the word here is actually Abhidhamma, while they engage in Abhidhamma talk. That's what it says, quite literal in suttas. So it's interesting, right? What does that mean? They engage in Abhidhamma talk. Does that mean that they are kind of reading the Abhidhamma? Or what does it actually refer to? And occasionally in the suttas, the word Abhidhamma comes up in the suttas. And it's interesting to think what it actually means in the particular context, because it is fairly well known in those circles who study the language of the text and this kind of thing, that the Abhidhamma is something that actually evolved after the Buddha passed away, a few centuries after the Buddha perhaps. So what does it mean when this word actually is used in the suttas in this way? And what it normally is taken to mean, it is taken to mean something to be about the suttas. That's why the translation here is pertaining to the Dhamma. It's concerning the Dhamma, about the Dhamma, that it actually means. So Yeah, so these things are quite tricky because sometimes people will say, they will quote the sutras, look, it says here, Abhidhamma, right? So it must mean the Abhidhamma was known. But unfortunately, things are not as simple as that. You have to understand kind of a bit about the history of the evolution of the text. And when you understand that, then you know that the Abhidhamma Pitaka, as we have it, is not really part of the earliest part of the discourses. Just for your information, right, just to make life a bit more interesting, a bit more confusing. It's as if it isn't confusing enough already. Anyway, the talk about the Dhamma, in questions and answers, Vedala is the Pali word for this. And, of course, the problem is that if you don't have a full grasp of what you're talking about, and this is what I was talking about before, about the problem of interpreting the suttas, right? Sometimes it can be difficult because some of the matters in the suttas are very profound. When we talk about non-self, we talk about the nature of Nibbana and these kind of things. These are very profound matters. And unless you have some teacher who has some direct understanding of these things, it can be very difficult. It can be possible to go wrong in the interpretation of these things. That is what is meant here by sliding into a dark Dhamma, a misinterpretation of the suttas. And once you misinterpret the suttas, there is a danger that you will never really be able to make the progress to the end of the path. Why? Because when you misinterpret the suttas, it means that, first of all, the practice may not be quite right? But even more important, even more problematic, is that you may misunderstand the goal of the Buddhist practice. And because you misunderstand it, you think you have attained the goal when you haven't really attained it. And that is very, very problematic. And there are other suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya which specifically mention this. They say that if you think that you have attained something when you haven't actually attained it, if you think you are a stream entry when you're not a stream entry, if you think you're an arahant when you're not an arahant, if you think you have jhanas when you haven't got the jhanas, if you think you're virtuous when you're not really virtuous, right? That's a bit easy to know, right? You know, this anger is okay, this is just my little kind of, this anger is necessary, is required. If you think like that, you're in trouble. So the problem is, once you think that you have attained what you haven't, you're actually blocking yourself, blocking your ability from attaining those states. Why? Because you think you got it already, right? So no need to kind of practice on, no need to go any further. And that is one of the things that is specifically mentioned as a blockage to the Dhamma in the future, moving on in the future. For that reason, this is quite important. Falling into a dark Dhamma sounds pretty bad, doesn't it? Dark Dhamma doesn't sound very good at all. Sounds like we are in serious trouble. So this is a dark teaching with dark results, right? It doesn't lead to the highest results that the Buddha is talking about. Then comes the next one. And it's the next one that I find the most important of these ones. And usually I just like to read out the next one and forget about all the other ones. But every time I do that, people ask afterwards, what are the other ones? You want to know the other ones? This time I included everything just to make sure that you see everything so you don't feel so kind of, he's hiding something. What are the things that we can't get to see? But I promise you, I don't really want to hide anything at all. I'm trying to be as open as possible. Sometimes I would anyway recommend you to go back and read some of these things on your own, right? I said just a second ago that this is only one sutta on future perils. So read the other ones as well. The other ones are, this is Anguttara, you can see it from the top of the pages, Anguttara 579. The other ones are Anguttara 577, Anguttara 578, and Anguttara 580. These are the other ones. So now you can go back and you can have a look at those, right? And if you haven't got the Anguttara Nikaya at home, then check it out on Sutta Central or Access to Insight or some other website where they have access to these suttas. There's more and more of these suttas coming online every day now, so that's all great news. So this is the most important one as far as I'm concerned. So again, in the future, and remember, we are now in the future, right? This is now. This does not mean any beyond this. There will be bhikkhus who are undeveloped in body, virtuous behavior, mind, and wisdom. When those discourses spoken by the Tathagata are being recited, that are deep, deep in meaning, world transcending, connected with emptiness, they will not want to listen to them, will not lend an ear to them or apply their minds to understand them. They will not think those teachings should be studied and learned. But when those discourses are being recited that are mere poetry composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by disciples, they will want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, and apply their minds to understand them. They will think that those teachings should be studied and learned. Thus, because through the corruption of the Dhamma comes corruption of the training. From the corruption of the training comes the corruption of the teaching. This is the fourth peril, future peril, as yet unarisen, that will arise in the future. You should recognize it and make an effort to abandon it. Right, and this is a big problem in Buddhism, and it has been a big problem for probably centuries already, and it's still a big problem now, and it quite likely will become even worse in the future. So, this is, I think, a really important one to keep in mind. People are always listening to all kinds of teachers, except for those discourses spoken by the Tathagata, right? Those are the ones that are mostly, oh, it's too difficult, don't know how to understand them, it's too hard. I just listen to this Ajahn, this Aya, this Sayado, this master, this Lama, or whatever it is, but not the Buddhas. That's too difficult for me here. Well, actually, one of the things that I have always found very interesting here is that when I read the suttas, the more you get into them, the more you start to understand them. They are very structured. They are very logical. They're put together in a very consistent way. It may seem hard to kind of break through initially, perhaps because the language can be a bit repetitive. The language can be a bit sort of stilted because it is an oral tradition and these kind of things. Sometimes it can seem a bit perhaps... the way it is phrased, perhaps old-fashioned because the translators haven't been so good. But once you start to get into the suttas, actually, it is far easier, in my opinion, to understand than modern teachers. Modern teachers, on the surface, it looks easy to understand. On the surface, it kind of seems very straightforward. But once you start to ask yourself, well, what do they actually mean by this? Does this mean samadhi? Does it mean jhana? What are they talking about here? And once you start to ask these questions, actually, it can be very hard to understand what many modern teachers are talking about. And I would say there is no modern teacher, there is no ancient teacher, there's no teacher after the time of the Buddha that had laid down the suttas, laid down the Dhamma in such a clear, consistent, coherent fashion as that which you find in the early Buddhist text, in the suttas, the agamas, and that kind of stuff. That is my claim. So you have to figure this out for yourself, see if you can enjoy this text, but that is what I say here. So, and once you get into these things, this kind of feeling comes out that there's something very nice going on here and something very, actually quite easy to understand in many ways. So, what is it that we are not listening to, the Buddha says? Well, it is those suttas that are deep, right? Gambhira. These things are profound, and they are profound in so many different ways. Of course, they are profound in the sense that they lead to very deep realization at the end of the path. But they're also profound in the sense that they are very comprehensive. They are very complete in the way that they are taught. So when we talk about things like sila, the virtuous behavior, and our character, and these kind of things, it sounds like such a simple thing. Yeah, I understand virtue. Right? But remember, when the Buddha talks about virtue, it is a very complete understanding of the idea of virtue. It has to do with our mind. It has to do with our perceptions, how we look at other people, how we deal with all kinds of situations. It is not just the simple kind of ideas of following certain rules. It is about our motivations, our intentions, where we're coming from, what is driving us in life, all of these kind of things. So virtue, sila itself, is very profound in its own right on the Buddhist path. Right? That is kind of a superficial profundity. And then, of course, comes the profundity of meditation practice, of the samadhi states, and all of these kind of things. And then, of course, the wisdom itself. But it's profound in many different ways, and it's important to keep that in mind as well. It's also profound in the way it explains simple things like generosity. Right? Often we think, oh yeah, generosity just means that you give. But the way the Buddha talks about generosity, he gives a lot of advice on how to be generous. What is the right way to do this? What is the right mind state to have when you're generous? Who you should give it to? Where you should give? And these are not as simple as you may think initially. For example, where should you give? The Buddha said, well, you should give where you feel peaceful, where you feel inspired, where you feel calmed about giving, right? That is where you should give. Usually you ask people, you should give to the arahants, right? That's where you should give. But the Buddha doesn't say that. He doesn't say you should give to the arahants. Why not? Because you don't know who the arahants are in the first place. That's why you shouldn't give to the arahants, right? So many of these things are actually, are there as part of the profundity of these teachings. And then it says they are deep, but not only are they are deep in meaning. And the meaning here means the atta, gambir atta. It is where these things are pointing to, is the things that we're trying to realize. The meaning is the goal of these teachings. So the meaning is deep, but also that thing that we realize when we get there is also profound, right? So both the meaning and the teaching themselves are profound. And be careful. Sometimes things may seem profound on the surface, but actually beneath the surface they may not be profound. Right? Sometimes you hear some fancy teachings, right? Some kind of, some Zen koans and that kind of stuff. And it may sound very kind of, the sound of one hand clapping and this kind of stuff. And perhaps it can have a beneficial effect on one's meditation, but many of these things, there's one thing I like to quote because it was so kind of outrageous, and that was the famous spiritual teacher Osho. You ever heard about Osho? Osho, okay. And he, turned out to be a really kind of scallywag. He was this Indian guru who then went to the United States and had all his followers, and he was very clever with speech. And one of the things that he said was that, I am so detached, I'm not even attached to detachment. Right? And then, of course, he had all these Rolls Royces, right, and all these kind of other things, because I'm not attached to detachment, right? So I can have all of these things, no problem for me here. And this is how he lived his life. But, of course, it turned out later on that he did all kind of bad stuff. He had all kind of terrible relationships with his disciples, all kind of things going on behind the scenes, right? So this is what can happen. Things sometimes sound profound, while in reality there isn't really any basis for it. You're clever with speech, but you haven't really got, there's no real, nothing behind it, so to speak. Window dressing, is that what they call it? Window dressing, I think, yeah. Okay, so they are deep in meaning, and this depth in meaning means that it is world transcending. Lok uttara is the Pali word here. It goes beyond the world. So what does that mean? Well, it means that the world here is defined in different ways. Just like in English, the word world in English can have many different meanings depending on how you use it. In English, you can say the whole world says, right? When you say the whole world says, you mean all of humanity says. Or the world can mean the earth, or the world can mean the universe, right? Depending on the context, what the word world means. And it's exactly the same in the Pali language. World, loka, can have exactly the same kind of range of meanings. So one of the meanings for the word loka is the world of sensuality, the kama loka. Right? So one of the transcendings of the Dhamma is that it transcends the kama loka, the world of sensuality, the world of sense pleasures, the world that we are normally immersed in around us. So it goes beyond that. And that means, of course, the samadhi, the jhanas, these kind of things. That is the first kind of Lokuttara state. Actually, in the suttas, the samadhi is not usually called Lokuttara. Lokuttara usually means even higher dhammas. This is just my kind of take on this. Because in the commentaries, you find the distinction between what they call the Lokuttara and Lokya jhanas. Jhanas that are Lokya, belonging to the world, and then jhanas that are Lokuttara, which have to do with which relate to the attainments of the stream entry, that sort of thing. But there is no real basis for that in the suttas. These are things that are found in the commentaries. And really, if you want to look at samadhi in the right way, I say it's more appropriate to call it Lokuttara, because you are already on the way out of this world when you get to these states, right? When you come to the jhanas, the world is left behind. And that's what it feels like. It feels like it's left behind. There's nothing there anymore. When you get to the jhanas, you are gone. You are beyond the ordinary world, right? And this is kind of the point of these things. But the real Lokuttara happens when you go even further on this path. And that is when you go to the point when you leave everything behind, including the jhanas, including the higher states of samadhi. That is the real Lokuttara, when everything is left behind, right? There's nothing in this world anymore, nothing that you have ever experienced that you haven't left behind in terms of craving and attachments and these kind of things. And that is the real Lokuttara, really beyond the entire world. So this is why this is so profound. Imagine leaving everything behind, and it's very hard to imagine even what that actually means. And then the last one is the connected with emptiness. And the agriya of emptiness in early Buddhist teachings, it is a synonym for non-self. The idea that there is no permanent entity inside, right? We are all empty human beings. Do you feel empty? Anyone feel empty? Sometimes so many things going on in the mind, we wish we were a bit more empty, right? Oh, too many things happening already. And this is one way of looking at emptiness, and to understand that emptiness actually is really good. You sit down, you meditate, you become peaceful, no more thinking going on, and you feel so happy because of that. And this is one way to understand that emptiness and non-self is a positive thing. It makes you feel happy when these things die down. Remember, the thinking mind is to a very large extent an extension of the ego. The ego wants to think. We think about who we are. We think about our career, our family, all of these things. We exist in a network. Our sense of identity depends on all of these factors in our world. I am from this country. I am from this family. I have this kind of education. I belong to a certain social class or whatever it is. And all of these things are what gives us a sense of identity. And when you sit down, we often think about these things. We defend ourselves. If somebody kind of upsets you, no, that's not true. You defend yourself, right? And the more empty you are inside, the less thinking there's going on, the less sense of identity you have. Right? And when you go into a state of samadhi, it is almost as if your entire identity as a person has disappeared. Yeah. And this is, you can see that the idea of non-self actually is incredibly beautiful. Non-self is great. It sounds scary, but kind of, it's really, really nice. Because the sense of ego is dying down. The sense of disruption and all of these problems in life are starting to disappear. So this is a good way of thinking about this. So it is connected with emptiness, the Buddha's teachings. And of course, emptiness becomes very profound. There's a beautiful sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya 121, the shorter sutta on emptiness. Talks about the gradual descent into emptiness, how gradually you become more and more empty inside. And as you do that, eventually you fully see the idea of non-self. And that is when you reached and eventually attain the supreme emptiness. And that is, of course, a very powerful, a very blissful experience when you see that. So this is the stuff that we are throwing out, right? The real deep things. And you don't want to listen to those anymore because you think, oh, too boring, too difficult, too hard to read, you don't want to read, don't know enough Pali yet, right? And all of this kind of stuff. And then you don't apply, lend an ear or apply your mind to understand these things. and you don't think that should be studied and learned. But instead, what you think should be learned is poetry. Hooray, poetry! So beautiful! Oh, the words are so nice, the phrases are beautiful. It's like going to an art exhibition. You feel so happy and so wonderful when you see all this beautiful poetry, right? And this is one of the problems in life, is that we tend to go for things that are beautiful, because this is our tendency. This is what karma is all about, the feeling that we want to see beautiful things in life. And this is why poetry can be so attractive, because precisely when it rhymes in a nice way, it has a certain length to the sentences, and it kind of is put together with nice words, we think, oh yeah, this is really cool, right? And you really like that. But it's really just an extension of karma loka, that we're seeing all of these beautiful things. We are attracted to beauty in this world. But remember, just because something is beautiful doesn't mean that it is profound, right? Often it is not profound at all. It often just has this beautiful feel to it. And even in the Buddhist teachings, we have to distinguish on the one hand between the prose, the things that is not poetry, and the poetry. And if you go to the Dhammapada, you find the poetry much more. If you go to the Sutta Nipata, that's where you find the poetry. The Theragata and the Therigata, the verses of the elder nuns and the monks, you find poetry. And often it is very beautiful, it is very clever, and it actually sounds very nice. And sometimes it is also profound, because some of these things actually are the words of the Buddha and the word of Arahants. So sometimes poetry can be combined with profundity. But remember that even within the Buddhist teachings, the poetry is secondary. It is the prose text, these kind of passages we're looking at now, these are primary. Why is that? And the reason is precisely because when you come to poetry, there are restrictions on what you can say. Poetry needs a certain number of syllables per line. It needs to rhyme in a certain way. It needs a certain pattern, right? It has to be beautiful, right? If it isn't beautiful, it's kind of pointless to have poetry here. So poetry, because of the limitations of poetry, you don't have the same freedom to express exactly what you need to express. In prose, there is no limitations. You have complete freedom to express exactly what you want. And that's why prose is the best way of explaining the Dhamma with as much precision as possible. So the idea of poetry is more to inspire you, to feel good, to feel nice. But make sure that when you read poetry, read the poetry of the Buddha, read the poetry of the Theras. Don't read the poetry of scallywags, right? Because there are too many scallywags around who come up with kind of nice sounding stuff, which isn't really all that great after all. I'm not suggesting that you should not see anything or hear anything beautiful in the world. Please see many beautiful things. But remember where the real essence is, the real profundity is. And when you know, remember that, that will be for your support for a long time in the future. So, poets and poetry, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders. Right? Outsiders are those who are not even Buddhists. People who are coming from all kinds of traditions. And sometimes there may be people outside of Buddhism that have nice things to say. And if they do, we can take that on board and we can use that to inspire ourselves, right? Sometimes people on the outside will say something very beautiful about how to be kind, how to be compassionate, and these kind of things. And when they do, and we feel that that helps us to be more kind and compassionate in the world, then please use these kind of things. That's perfectly okay. We shouldn't just throw away everything that everybody else says as rubbish. If we do, we're also going too far, right? We have to find this balance. Everything in Buddhism is about the middle way here. Right, middle way is kind of a very crucial word in the Buddhist teachings. But what it means rather is that we don't emphasize the word of outsiders above the word of the Buddha. The point here is that we think that the word of outsiders should be listened to, but not the word of the Buddha. That's the point here. So we emphasize the word of the outsiders more than the word of the Buddha. And that is where we go wrong. Right? So yes, we listen to it, but in the end, it is the word of the Buddha that is the final standard for what is the real teachings. One of those little nice sayings I remember from talking about outsiders. There's a French saying which says that to understand all is to forgive all. Right? When you understand everything, when you understand other people, you understand where they're coming from, what motivates them, what drives them. Right? You realize that anybody in that situation would have acted in the same way. Because they are conditioned to act in that way. So to understand everything, to understand why people do things, even when people do something bad, they are driven to do that by causes and conditions. Not really because they want to do bad things, but because they have no choice. So the French saying is that to understand all is to forgive all. Tout comprendre, c'est tout pardonner, is a French saying. To understand all is to forgive all. And it's a very nice little saying. And these little things are kind of things that can sometimes help you to kind of, you know, to on the path. And then, of course, it can be very useful. Created by outsiders, spoken by disciples, right? This is the last one here. You listen to the disciples before you listen to the Buddha. And that, I think, is perhaps the most important one of all of these things here. Because it is important to remember that in Buddhist history, everyone is disciples. Every teacher that has existed in Buddhist history, apart from the Buddha himself, is a disciple. Right? Every single one, starting with Venerable Sariputta, all the way down the line to the present day, to the most junior person who is a Buddhist, right? Like whoever that might be. Everyone is a disciple of the Buddha. So remember that, right? Because this is precisely what I was talking about before. We tend to take refuge in all of these teachers. We tend to listen. This is why when we talk about the commentaries, for example, or the Abhidhamma, we know that it wasn't taught by the Buddha, so we shouldn't elevate the Abhidhamma as something higher than the suttas. This is what you find in the Buddhist world. They say that the Abhidhamma is the ultimate teaching. If you want to find the real Dhamma, go to the Abhidhamma. The suttas are kind of secondary, right? This is one of these things that you see happening in Buddhist history, where you are looking at the teachings of the disciples rather than looking at the teachers of the Buddha himself. Same thing with the commentaries. The commentaries were written down a long time after the Buddha. Again, it is the disciples that have written these down. It's Buddhaghosa. Some of it may be great, some of it may be useful, some of the Abhidhamma may be useful, but remember, it is not the final teaching that we should be going to. Same thing with the Mahayana suttas, right? Some of the Mahayana suttas may be very inspiring and very interesting in their own way, but again, it is the work of the disciples. Right? Any modern teacher, any book that you read in the modern day, exactly the same thing here. So this is quite radical. So when you read the suttas and you say a certain sutta was spoken by Venerable Ananda, right? Straight away, you know that sutta should not be given as much weight as the word of the Buddha himself. So in this way, you kind of get your priorities right. You see what actually matters and what is important. And this changes our entire way of looking at these things. And of course, this shows us again why going back to the suttas is so important and matters so much. And I despair. I hear people saying that, oh yeah, not people, but even monks. Well, the suttas, you know, they're not really complete. There is stuff missing in there, you know. Listen to me instead. I will give you the real teachings and that kind of stuff. And it is actually very dangerous, because it is the way that leads away from the Dhamma. There's always a danger that Dhamma will be corrupted. And when the teaching is corrupted, then the training will be corrupted as a consequence. And then you get this kind of cascading effect that you're seeing here mentioned in this particular sutta. Anyway, so don't know what you think about that, but that's what I think about it. So there you are. Okay, so let us now look at the last one, the last of these five future perils. Again, in the future, there will be bhikkhus who are undeveloped in body, undeveloped in virtuous behavior, and undeveloped in mind, and undeveloped in wisdom. The elder bhikkhus, being undeveloped in body, virtue, mind, and wisdom, will be luxurious and lax, leaders in backsliding, discarding the duty of solitude. They will not arouse energy for the attainment of the as yet unattained, for the achievement of the as yet unachieved, for the realization of the as yet unrealized. Those in the next generation will follow their example. They too will be luxurious and lax, leaders in backsliding, discarding the duty of solitude, and they too will not arouse energy for the attainment of the as yet unattained, for the achievement of the as yet unachieved, for the realization of the as yet unrealized. Thus, because through the corruption of the teaching comes the corruption of the training, and from the corruption of the training comes the corruption of the teaching. This is the fifth future peril, as yet unarisen, that will arise in the future. You should recognize it and make an effort to abandon it. Right, so here again we have monastics that have not been practicing properly. So they haven't got that sense restraint, they haven't got the higher virtue, they haven't got the samadhi and the wisdom. And of course the problem is, if you don't have the results of the Buddhist path, if you don't have the happiness that comes from these kind of, from this path, you will try to find happiness somewhere else. Because we need to be happy, right? We need to have a sense of meaning in life. We need to have a sense of pleasure. If life becomes completely miserable, it becomes completely pointless at the same time. We need to enjoy life, otherwise it's meaningless. And I hope you all come here to enjoy the Buddhist teachings, right? Not to become miserable from the Buddhist teachings. That's why I'm a Buddhist, because I think it's great, because it makes me happy. That's the only reason I'm a Buddhist. I hope you, it's the same with you. But too many Buddhists are kind of miserable Buddhists, right? I would not recommend being a miserable Buddhist. Be a happy Buddhist, for goodness sake. Because without happiness, life really is meaningless. The whole Buddhist teaching is a movement towards happiness and a movement away from suffering. Every stage of the path should give you some of that meaning, some of that happiness. But if you don't find it, like these bhikkhus here, you don't find that happiness because you're not practicing properly, you will look for it elsewhere. That's the natural inclination of the mind. It will go for happiness wherever it can find it. If it's not in the Dhamma, it will be elsewhere. Where is that? In sensuality, right? Maybe in power, maybe in authority, in status, social status, or whatever it is. But especially in sensual pleasures. That is where you will look for these things. So you will kind of think, yeah, enough about living in the forest. Now I'll go to live in the city so I can get better supported, right? And I can kind of do things and like a kind of, whatever it is, you know, sleep more comfortably, use the internet more, and all this kind of stuff. And as you do that, you start sliding backwards, and you have big buildings and big houses that you live in, and all of this kind of stuff. So you become luxurious, leaders in backsliding, too much comfort, and you start living more like a layperson than as a monastic. And it's natural, it's just a natural inclination of the mind. You become leaders in backsliding, right? That sounds pretty bad, doesn't it? Sliding, going backwards, worse and worse, becoming more and more luxurious in the way you do things. So this is an important way to also to look, to decide, you know, who are the good monastics in the world, is how do they actually live? Do they live simply, or do they live in luxury? And this actually is one of the ways of deciding these matters. And discarding the duty of solitude, right? Because again, solitude usually means that you have the ability to find happiness somewhere else. In the forest, when you're far away from support, as far away from humanity, there's no socializing, you live in a simple cutie somewhere, there is very limited scope for indulging in luxury and these kind of things. So you have to find the happiness somewhere else normally. And that's why, I must admit, sometimes I'm very impressed by some of these monastics who really live way in the jungle, right? And they do that for years and decades on end, and seemingly very happily so. And I find that is very, very inspiring when I see those things. Maybe we can talk a bit more about that later on this retreat, when we talk maybe more about the Sangha and that sort of stuff. So, and of course, as always, when you have a teacher who is luxurious, it same thing happens with the students, right? The next generations happens exactly the same thing. And this is why when I see monks and nuns, perhaps, who don't keep the Vinaya, don't keep the monastic rules, I don't normally blame them, because I know normally the reason why they do that is because that's what they have learned from their teachers. The teachers didn't practice properly, and of course then the students happens exactly the same thing, right? So when the teachers use money, the student also use money, because they are used to that. They have learned that from the very beginning. And once the corruption kind of sets in, very often it's very difficult to turn back, because you get used to a certain way of living, a certain way of dealing with these things. And that's why it is hard to turn these things around again. So, this is how this happens. And then, again, you get the corruption of the teaching. You don't really know the teaching. The training stops, and because the training stops, you don't get the teaching again. So these two things revolve around each other. The teaching and the realization have to come together. These bhikkhus are the five future perils as yet unarisen that will arise in the future. You should recognize them and make an effort to abandon them. So that is the five future peril sutta. Okay, so keep those things in mind. The most important things among these things to my mind is this idea of not to forget the word of the Buddha, right? And what is so interesting, of course, is that if you don't read the word of the Buddha, you don't even know that not reading the word of the Buddha is wrong, because it says in the word of the Buddha. That's the only place you can find these things, right? So because you're not reading the word of the Buddha, you don't even get started to understand that these things are problematic. So this is one of those things, and it kind of becomes a catch-22 situation when you cannot really get out of this anymore. You go around the vast majority of the Buddhist world, and you see it is what they call the Acharyavada. Acharyavada is a doctrine of the teachers. It's not the Buddha Vachana, the word of the Buddha, but it often tends to be the Acharyavada instead, where things are passed down from one generation of teacher to the next one, and the word of the Buddha is kind of hidden away. If you go to certain many monasteries, I don't know so much about other kind of, but certainly what I know about is like Thailand. And very commonly in Thailand, you find that the Tipitaka is in this beautiful cabinet, right? Very beautiful cabinet. And you can see glass windows, and you can see the Tipitaka behind there. But the cabinet is locked, right? You can't get in there. The reason why it's there, so you can come down in the morning, you can bow down to the Tipitaka, you can worship the Tipitaka, but you cannot read the Tipitaka. The Tipitaka is out of bounds. So you, it says here that you should read it, right? But no, you cannot read it in those monasteries. And this is where we have things have gone wrong, right? It's the message that matters. It is not the worshipping of these things that is important. So for that reason, of course, and as monastics, we should really be taking a lead in these things, doing things the right way. But sometimes, unfortunately, that is not what happens. Because sometimes, as it says here, the corruption has already set in, and that makes it all problematic and difficult to get out of that state again. Anyway, so there you are. So That is just a warning. And of course, the future is always evolving. So there's always a future. It can get even worse. So we still should do our very best to heed these teachings and then maybe try to correct some of those faults that already happened in the Buddhist world. Anyway, let's have a short break. Have a cup of tea and chance to go to the toilet and that sort of thing. And then we'll see you again at 10:45.